Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I am Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. Here's four quick connections that we have to America's space program. I have interviewed and have become friendly with one of the NASA scientists, one of the early guys responsible for much of the scientific equipment needed to land our first spacecrafts on the moon, Henry Richter. And he had a leadership role also in the scientific instrumentation for NASA's Mariner spacecraft, the equipment that enabled it to successfully explore Mercury, Venus, and Mars. And then we interviewed a longtime NASA lead technical administrator for the Cassini-Saturn mission, David Coppedge, responsible for the ground computers so that mission control could manage that astoundingly successful spacecraft. And third, I have a photograph taken in the International Space Station. Now, the NASA astronaut who snapped the photo has said that it's against NASA policy to promote products. So he's asked me not to publish it on our website. But this is a photo from just a few years ago of one of the science resources that we sell here at Real Science Radio, floating in zero gravity in front of a portal from where you can see the beautiful blue Earth in the darkness of space. And then lastly, my wife Cheryl and I have a standing invitation to go to Cape Canaveral in Florida to see a launch. And you know, there just was an Atlas V rocket launched on April 18th that we couldn't get to, but we're eager to get down there. Now, with all that, none of it compares to the honor of speaking with an actual astronaut. Especially, imagine if you could talk to one of the 12 men who actually walked on the moon. Wow, of those 12 astronauts, Captain Bean, welcome to Real Science Radio. Of those 12, what number were you?
Well, I was number four. I was on the second mission. Neil and Buzz and Mike Collins then were on the first. And then Pete Conrad was the commander. Dick Gordon was in orbit around the moon. And I was fortunate enough to walk around on the moon, do some work there with Pete Conrad.
Wow. So the fourth astronaut to walk on the moon is who we are talking with right now. And that was in mid-November 1969. I was just 10 years old. You were in your mid-30s or so. Is that about right?
That's right. I was born in 1932. And Pete was a couple years older. Dick was about a year older. And that's pretty much the age most of us were during Apollo. In fact, I've often thought back, we were blessed just accidentally being born within that two or three or four, 5 year period.
Sure.
Because we were the right age to go do these sorts of things, where astronauts being born now, well, being born now, they're probably going to get some chances to go. But the present day astronauts, all are, you know, getting great adventures in the space station. And other things, they're not going to get a chance to go to the moon, and they're not going to get a chance to go to Mars. So
wow,
that's just part of, you know, the luck of life. A lot of luck is involved in life, in my opinion.
Alan, I love how you refer to these men known around the world as Neil and Buzz and Pete. It's so very encouraging to speak with you because of your firsthand knowledge of this historic moment in the entire history of the human race and, of course, in the American space program. What I'd like to ask you about, if we could just systematically go through the training involved and, of course, the selection process, and then the flight there and back, landing on the moon, your time on its surface, and then even the splashdown back on Earth. So that's quite a bit. But first, I think we should let the audience know that your space career isn't really over, because you have been producing fine art, the most beautiful paintings of our astronauts on the surface of the moon, the Earth rising in the background, the lunar lander. How many of these paintings have you created so far?
Well, Bob, first of all, thank you for bringing that up, because that's what I'm doing every day, including today. I painted this morning. I get up about 5 in the morning, and I eat a breakfast, do a little exercise, and then paint, and then I take a break for lunch and the like. But I've done about 170 paintings, but that's not a lot, considering I've been doing this full-time since 1983. However, what happens is all these spacesuits, in order to look right, you've got to paint the hoses, you've got to paint the connectors, you've got to paint the fittings, you've got to paint the gloves, and if you just kind of give it a quick brush, like you might be able to do some other kinds of art,
yeah,
it doesn't look like a spacesuit.
Now, Astronaut Bean, we've traveled the world in our quest to understand, you know, reality, the world we live in, even the universe. But when we were in Venice in Italy, there was a modern art convention, and we would look at these paintings. We're there in really the capital of the Renaissance art of the world, and we'd look at these modern art paintings, and I'd say to my wife, I'd say, Cheryl, I could do that. And if I could do that, that's not art. But your paintings are the detail that's in the paintings and how it brings us back to those incredible years in the 1960s. When we're done with the interview, I'd like us to tell the audience how to find your website, of course, alanbean.com, but then the galleries, Gallery 1, Gallery 2, Gallery 3, and Gallery 4. Maybe you could describe for us one of the paintings on each of those galleries at the end of our interview.
Okay, I think I could do that, because I've got two websites, as you say, alanbean.com. And then alanbeangallery.com.
Yes.
For those of your listeners that are interested, that's a good place to look around and, you know, see what you think, see what you like. This was a big decision for me when I was an astronaut. I was training to fly the shuttle. I just come down from Skylab and backing up the ASTP Russian mission. And I looked around the office and I said, you know, there's a lot of young men and women here that can fly the space shuttle as good as I can or better, but I'm the only one of the 12 of us that got a chance to walk on the moon that cares about art. That was my hobby when I was a test pilot and through the astronaut years. And I said, maybe if I could leave the program and learn to be a better painter, then I could leave some of these stories that would be lost forever. That's why I left. That's why I work. I always feel like I'm trying to pay back in a way for the great gift that was given me.
Your paintings they have become very desirable among collectors. Could I ask you, of the 170 that you've painted, maybe this is too personal a question, how many have been purchased?
Well, I would say, first of all, I'm not positive, but let's say 140.
Wow. So,
but it may be 130 or 150.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm always trying to tell a story. Some stories are known because they're in, you know, in videos, in photographs that we took on the moon, in the books that astronauts wrote. Some stories aren't, and so I just try to tell interest. Right now, I'm working on a painting of Neil and Buzz, nearly finished, Neil and Buzz, when at the end of the AVA, they read the plaque on the front leg of the limb where it was said something like, first of all, it had an image there, an image of the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere. And then below it, it said something like this: here men from the planet Earth first landed on the moon, wow, July of 1969, and then it had their names and signatures. And so you could imagine that if some aliens came someday and landed on the moon and saw that, they would look up in the sky and they would, as the Earth turned up there, yeah, they would say, that's where this piece of machinery came from.
That's where it came
from. Let's get back in our spaceship and go to Earth. Go to that place up there. That's where they live.
It came from that planet. Now, maybe later at the end of our interview, we could talk a bit about that. I don't have any high expectation that aliens will be coming to the moon, but I would like to ask you now about the training to become a lunar module pilot. I would think your training really began in the Navy when you were being catapulted off of carriers and then having to land back on them.
It did in a way, Bob. When NASA began to think about flying somebody in space, this was back before Mercury, where, you know, Alan Shepard flew in space first, and then John Glenn, that was the first American to orbit the Earth. They went to President Eisenhower, and they said, we're going to have a space program. We're going to send up some astronauts, and we've decided that this thing is so dangerous that we're going to pick prisoners. If they survive the flight, we'll give them, you know, time off their sentence. And what? President Eisenhower said, wait a minute, you haven't thought about this well enough. These people are going to become important when they do this.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, you need a certain kind of people to train. There's military pilots.
Oh, wow. I'm so
in
glad.
The Air Force, yeah, and the Navy, the Marines.
Yeah.
They might like to. You go back and run a selection program and see if you can find some people, you know, military people. And that's really where Al Shepard came from, and John Glenn, Marine. Al Shepard, Navy.
Wow.
Gus Grissom, Air Force. Wally Schirra, Navy. And the reason they did that is because flying high-performance airplanes was the closest analog to what they thought flying spaceships would be. So even though football players are more athletic, we didn't need somebody athletic. We needed somebody that could fly machinery in space. So, you know, race car drivers, they're probably really skilled, but they're not skilled in three-dimensional space. They're skilled on the Earth, two-dimensional.
Yeah.
So this was why, you know, these guys and me and others that fly the space shuttle now and will fly in the future when we rocket people in space, that's the kind of people you're going to pick.
Wow. So you were a Navy aviator. Our engineer right now, Jamie, who you talked to a moment ago, he was in radio on one of our naval ships on an aircraft carrier. So he's shared many times with me the stories of what it's like. But to have to land back on one after being catapulted off one, those are extraordinary accomplishments. So I'm glad the president back then had the insight not to take a criminal and make him a celebrity and go to our best and our brightest, our most well-trained.
That's right. And they would have had bad luck because you just pick a prisoner. He could be good at this stuff or not. However, the people that they ended up picking were, you know, the best of the pilots that, you know, had been doing this for years. And like any profession, as they say, to become, you know, highly skilled, it takes 10,000 hours of training and experience to do that. Well, you're not going to find any pilot prisoners with 10,000 hours of experience. They wouldn't be in jail.
Yeah. Unless maybe you went to the Ohio Marion Correctional Institution. I don't know if you've heard this brand new news story, Captain Bean, but these prisoners at the Marion Correctional Institution, they made their own computers and they hid them in the ceilings at a certain part of the jail, and they connected them to the network used for the correctional institution there in Ohio. So they're pretty sharp prisoners.
Yes, but, they are.
But regardless, I'm glad it all went the way it did. So how is it then that you were selected?
Well, NASA needed astronauts, and so they went to the services and said, we were going to pick some new astronauts. Would you please run a selection and then give us, you know, the ones that you think would be good candidates? Incidentally, this is the way we pick scientists. We go to the National Science Academy and say, we need a geologist or two. You run a selection program and send us the names of four or five geologists that you think are great geologists. We'll go through those four or five and try to pick out the one or two that we think would make the best astronauts. That way we would, you know, get the most qualified people that we thought were not, NASA not qualified to say who's the best geologist. That's why we did it that way. So the Navy then went down, and in their wisdom of the people that wanted to do it, they said Alan Bean is the right age, and he's a pretty good guy.
So you and Pete Conrad were both with the Navy. Did you know one another before NASA?
I did. When I was selected as a test pilot to come to test pilot school, he had been there a couple years, and he was an instructor. He was my instructor in performance.
Wow.
And so, you know, he would teach my class performance, how you do, how you test airplanes for their performance, things like that. And so I got to know him there. Dick Gordon and he were in the same test pilot class, so they knew each other. I didn't know Dick Gordon. But, see, Al Shepard, I didn't know what astronauts were. I was a test pilot. I thought I had the greatest job in the world. And one day I walk in the ready room, and I see everybody looking at this little black and white TV. I said, what are you looking at? Well, this guy, this Navy guy, Al Shepard, is gonna fly on a rocket in space. He's an astronaut. I could even spell it. I said, well, I'll watch it. I looked at that thing, and I watched him go, and after his 15-minute flight, I thought, you know, in 15 minutes, that guy's gone higher than I've ever gone, faster than I've ever gone, and made more noise doing it. Maybe he's got the best job in the world. How do I get his job? How do I get... And then I looked into it. I didn't know anything about it. And it turns out Al Shepard had been a test pilot there at the Naval Air Test Center about 5 years before me. So I accidentally ended up in the pipeline.
Oh, yeah, right where he came through.
Yes, so, and that's where I came through. That's where Pete came through. Dick Gordon, Neil Armstrong, for example.
Captain Bean, this question is out of the blue, but do you have grandkids?
I sure do.
Because hopefully they have heard all of these stories many times over.
No. No. I've never had a grandkid. I've got eight.
Yeah.
I've never had a grandkid say to me, hey, Granddad, what was it like on the moon? Granddad, or anything, or how was your training? Any of these questions you're asking, they've never asked me in their life.
Okay, we're going to fire the whole lot of them.
No, they have their own dreams.
They do.
They do. I think this is important to say. If you have a dream for the future, maybe yours was to be a broadcaster, Bob. I don't know. Maybe you'll tell us that in a second.
Yeah.
You are lucky, because if you've got it, first of all, to do anything is a lot of hard work, time, and effort. And if you don't dream to do it and think it would be wonderful and love it, it's hard to do all that work.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I run into people frequently, young men and women, that don't have a dream. And if you don't, I don't know if you can get one. You know, they're not sure what they want to do.
Yeah. But they'll find their way.
Maybe. No, yeah. I don't agree with that one bit. But
yeah,
I'm asking you, when you were a boy, what'd you want to do?
Well, as a young teenager, I used to listen to Michael Jackson, not the singer, but the radio talk show host out of New York City on WABC, 770 AM. And eventually, he was on late at night. I got a phone. My parents thought I was asleep, and I would call in to his show.
I'm not surprised.
And he got such a kick out of a young kid calling to talk about foreign policy. So anyway, I could understand the desire, the dream, the vision. When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, that was Apollo 11.
Yes.
You were Apollo 12.
Yes.
So when you were then selected and then began the actual NASA training, could you tell us just something about that stage?
Okay. Well, the way it works, when you're selected, you know, they're getting ready to, they have a need for you to fly certain flights in the future, because that's why they picked you, and because they're getting ready to spend a lot of effort, time, and money essentially training you. So first thing you do after you get there is you get about a year, I call it basic training. You learn how to wear a spacesuit, how to check it out. You learn how to do launches in general, the kind of the principles. Then you learn how to do entries. Then you learn how to do on-orbit maneuvers.
Wow.
Then you'd learn a lot of these different things. You learn how spacecraft are built. You learn how rockets are built, things like that.
Mm.
That takes about a year. By the way, during this time, you go and train in case you came down in the jungle. You go in the jungle and spend a week, you know, learning that.
Yeah.
You go out in the desert. You learn how to survive in the desert. You learn how to survive in the water, how to come down in a parachute, a lot of other things. And then you change sort of from an astronaut candidate, you could call it, to an astronaut. And so after that year, then you can't go from right there to begin training. You're not smart enough yet. So they put you on support crews. So you've got a prime crew, and let's say an Apollo of three people. Then you have a backup crew of three people. And both those crews are learning the same thing, which we'll talk about later. But then there's a support crew that isn't doing all the training, but they're going along, picking up what they can, and doing jobs like checking out the command module prior to flight or something. There's so much work to be done, and that way they sort of learn more things. And as a result of that, then the best ones of the support crew, then they get moved up to the backup crew of a mission upcoming. I was on two backup crews. I backed up Gemini 10, and then Pete Dick and I backed up Apollo 9.
Mm.
And then we cycled to the prime crew three crews later of Apollo 12. Like Neil, Mike, and Buzz were the backup for Apollo 8.
Wow.
And they cycled to 11. So that's kind of the way it's done, and it's... It takes a long time to learn these skills. It's what I like it, liken it to a bit. You can't grab somebody off the street and make him a pro quarterback. It can't be done any more than you can take a prisoner and make him an astronaut. You can't do that. You've got to take a guy that played football in, let's say quarterback, for example, in high school.
Mm.
And he was good enough at it so that colleges, you know, picked him and gave him a scholarship. And then he was good enough in college so that the pros draft him and see if he can become a pro quarterback. A lot of them can't.
Mm.
That's exactly how it's done with astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
Except more good military pilots can become astronauts than good college quarterbacks that can become pro quarterbacks. So it's not as selective as that. But it shows you that you have to have years of working on these skills.
Mm. You mentioned Apollo 9. A little later, I'd like to ask you something about Apollo 8. But first, if we can now get to, and I realize we'll be jumping over an important part of this history, but when you're ready to launch on your mission, Apollo 12, what was that like and the actual flight there to the lunar orbit?
Well, first of all, we'd practiced this in simulators a number of times. We'd gotten into our real spacecraft and run tests. you know, we were familiar with this. But we knew in those times we really weren't going. And I can remember we get in the spacecraft. If those of your listeners that have seen Apollo 13, very descriptive movie, very accurate in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so about 15 minutes prior to launch, I began to really dawn on me, hey, we're really going to go today. We're really going to launch on this Saturn V. And the thoughts that I believe go through most astronaut minds is not, I hope this thing doesn't blow up and I get killed. It's, I hope that if something happens, I can remember how I was trained and perform with perfection. That is how test pilots think. They want to do their job with perfection. They know they're just human and they probably can't. But they want to do it well enough so that there's no big mistakes. It's their fault. And anyway, that kind of went through my head.
You know,
and then
that I hate to interrupt you, Captain Bean, but that just happened about a few weeks ago. We had two astronauts on a spacewalk outside of the International Space Station, and they were installing a panel, and it got loose. And it was lost. And, you know, it's a great sadness. And people make mistakes. No matter how well-trained people are, you do something long enough, you make mistakes. So I don't personally blame the astronaut when this piece of equipment flew off into space. I don't blame her. But it certainly cost a tremendous amount of money. And I know she'll regret it throughout her life.
Well, you're absolutely right. But we all know that you are asked to perform at your best, and you can't always do it. People lose the Super Bowl in the last minute, like the quarterback there for Atlanta Falcons. He was great for almost game lasts an hour.
Yeah.
He was a great quarterback for 55 minutes, and that last 5 minutes, he had to sit still while some other quarterback was great, and he lost the game. Mm. So I don't blame him, and I don't blame her either.
No.
Everybody there is trained, and they've been picked because they're as good humans as you can get. Then you hope you can do your best.
Astronaut Bean, I'm so glad you made that point, because when people make mistakes, we should have a tremendous amount of grace toward them. It's only when people are immoral or deceptive or doing something actually ethically wrong that we criticize people. But when they're trying their best and they can't accomplish what they're attempting, that still is praiseworthy.
So, it really is.
Yeah.
I would have to say, now I've got to say this, those that are trying their best and it works out, as opposed to those that are trying the best and it doesn't, there is some credit, extra credit, to be given to those that make it work out.
Well,
I think of the crew of Apollo 13.
Yes.
Where their rocket, not their rocket, but their spacecraft didn't work right, yet they were able to make it work out. I often think of the best performance of a crew in Apollo, and it wasn't Apollo 12, and it wasn't Apollo 11 either. In my opinion, it was Apollo 13, because those guys had to perform flawlessly in backup procedures that you don't practice near as much. Mm. And I can remember, as I watched them go through their different maneuvers and burns, I was thinking, boy, when I practiced this in the simulator, I didn't do it very well. I hope Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes can do better than I did. And they did, every time.
I have worried, like, emotionally, when I've thought about getting in the lunar module. Neil Armstrong, when he stepped onto the moon, that was July 1969. I was just 10 years old. So our family, we watched that live on television, but not right then, but some years later, I remember reading, learning about that mission. And I actually would get nervous, physically nervous, thinking about the demands on the lunar module pilot to take off and then rendezvous in space. And if you miss that, then that's it. It's over. You are lost in space.
That's right. You can't miss that. But don't forget, you train in the simulator. They would never let you go into space if you couldn't do this repeatedly in the simulator. Mm. However, if something broke and you couldn't do it, then, you know, something could be. One thing you learn as a pilot and also an astronaut, and think about this a little bit, everything breaks eventually. Mm. Your car is going to break.
Yeah.
Now, probably your car won't break this year. Probably your car won't even break next year. But it will. If you keep it long enough, it'll break.
Yeah, it's entropy.
Yes. And so I'll tell you one of the funny feelings I had on the mission. The minute we burned the engine to leave the Earth, and then we had like 2.5 days flying between the Earth and the Moon, I knew things could break. That's when Apollo 13's broke. Mm. I wanted instantly to be in lunar orbit so that we could not get the equipment exposed to 2 or 3 more days where they could break. Now, I know you couldn't do it, but that was what I was in a hurry to get through each of these things before something broke.
Yeah, right, right. So
I told you already. Yeah. And Apollo 13, they left the Earth, and then they had a big thing break, their oxygen tank. So
I don't know if you recall this part of the history, NASA's history, and heading to the moon, but the discovery of the Van Allen radiation belt, our dear friend and a past guest on Real Science Radio is Dr. Henry Richter, and it was his idea. He argued that we needed to put a Geiger counter on one of the early missions. And that's how the Van Allen radiation belt was discovered.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that was his brilliant insight, and what a guy he is. In fact, he's still doing well. He's writing a book right now. It's about done. The title will be something like Spaceship Earth.
That's a good title.
Yeah, about the astounding fine-tuning of the Earth that we live in, how perfect it is for human beings to prosper. But so when you flew to the moon, we already knew that there was quite a bit of radiation out there.
We knew that, and we all carried on our suits little counters, and we'd read back the data to mission control, and the doctors there were aware. We'd built the spacecraft to shield the crew members for radiation. We made the spacesuit sort of like that, too. For example, the layers of the spacesuit under your arms, there weren't very many because the radiation is not impacting there. The suit insulation between you and the backpack wasn't very thick, but the ones on the front were. So you were worried about radiation, and you were worried about micrometeorites hitting you and punching a hole in your suit or something. So people were careful about these things, as careful as we could be with what we knew.
I am so thrilled that we're living in the age of private space firms, like SpaceX, for example. I don't know if you run across these people, but being in radio for 26 years now, 5 days a week, we're on Colorado's most powerful station, the 50,000-watt AM 670 KLTT, the blowtorch of the Rockies. And now and then we come across people who claim that, you've probably heard it, that we never went to the moon. I was so thrilled when Buzz Aldrin, a producer, one of those videos caught up to him. And Buzz, I think in total Christian love, he punched the guy right in the face.
Yeah, I've seen that video.
Yeah,
that's a good video.
That was just the absolute best thing to do. But today, if one of these leaders of this crazy movement, the flat earth movement and all this insanity, if they want to, they could take a collection from their supporters and buy a seat and go on a spacecraft. They could fly on a private spacecraft and see that the earth is round for starters. And what a wonderful time it is to be alive when with the internet and all this technology, we can show people in the most astounding ways the truth.
Well, that's true. But I, in my opinion, watching this, once again, just an opinion,
yeah,
these individuals, my feeling about this, and then I'm going to have to get off this conversation. My opinion about this is everybody wants to be special. Mm. Everybody wants to be special, okay? Mm-hmm. You can be special because you've got a good job and you perform well, and so you feel special, okay? So can Tom Brady. So can Alan Bean. These people that have these thoughts like that, they don't, in my opinion, once again, they don't believe the earth's flat. But by talking that way and taking that position, they think they make themselves special.
Yeah, they differentiate themselves.
They differentiate themselves. They're special. They know more theoretically than you do. None of them, I guarantee, will get on a rocket, not because they're afraid, but they're not going to do things to show that they're wrong.
Well,
they're only going to do things to show that they're right. So it's okay. People come up to me frequently and say they don't believe. I say, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. That doesn't hurt. You know, that doesn't hurt. I believe we did, but, you know, your opinion is good, too. So it doesn't bother me. It's just they're wasting, in my opinion, they're wasting their time. They need to learn to be special some way
other than that. Some other way. Astronaut Bean, you may have heard of one of NASA's guests in space. He was from Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abd Ed Aziz bin Baz. They invited him to fly into space because he had said that the world is flat.
Yes.
And he said, no one could convince me otherwise. NASA literally took him as a guest up into space, and he came back and he said, guess what? The world's not flat. I've seen it with my own eyes.
And that's a good story.
Isn't that just great? We wrote about that in a science journal just a couple of years ago.
That's a good story.
So,
well, look, Bob, I enjoyed this. Thank you for having me on your program, and good luck for the future.
Thank you so very much, Captain Bean. What an honor. May God bless you. Well, that was astronaut Alan Bean, and he told us he was born in 1932, so that makes him, 85 years old. He was so wonderfully expressive in answering the questions that I asked. And so even though we ran out of time with Captain Bean, there are a couple things that I would like to present so you guys in the audience could think them through. I know that he mentioned that he thought one day perhaps aliens may land on the moon. So in a few minutes, I'd like to give you a list of some observations of why we recognize that the UFOs that have been claimed to have been seen are not piloted by aliens from a galaxy far, far away or from planets orbiting a star system far away. In fact, they're not from any alien civilization. I'd like to give you a list of observations to indicate that. Also at Real Science Radio, we've made a prediction about UFO sightings, so I'd like to share that with you. But before those things, I mentioned Buzz Aldrin and how he was confronted by this conspiracy theory filmmaker, and he gave him a right cross, punch in the face, just the perfect response, I believe. When Buzz Aldrin stands before God, I don't think God is going to be mad at him for hitting this guy. The first eating and drinking on the moon. Do you remember what it was? What was eaten first on the moon? This was Buzz Aldrin, and he took Holy Communion on the moon. He took the bread and the wine, and that was the very first eating and drinking of a human being on the moon. That's just so awesome. That was Apollo 11, the mission before astronaut Alan Beans. Let's go back to Apollo 8. They had their Christmas mission. In fact, it was December 24th, 1968. They rounded the moon for the ninth time. This is on Christmas Eve, and they began an extraordinary television transmission. It was, at the time, the most watched broadcast in history. So there were three astronauts who spoke: William Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman. So this is before Neil Armstrong stepped down onto the surface of the moon. So they left Earth and traveled those 2.5 days to the moon and were orbiting the moon. And on their ninth time, they were just coming about the sunrise, the lunar sunrise. And here is what was said.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise. And for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and divided the light from the darkness.
And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning the second day.
Okay, now we will link from our website, rsr.org. You can go to /moon. So rsr.org/moon. That will be an easy way to find today's program. Also, rsr.org/astronautbean will get you there, B-E-A-N. We will link to that full audio. We ended it right there after day two, because there's a fascinating thing to observe there. God said, after day one, he said, "It is good," in the evening and the morning, day one. And throughout the creation week, God says, "It is good, it is good, it is good." At the very end, he summed it all up: "It is very good." God impressed himself with the creation, and that's some accomplishment. Well, on day two, God did not say it is good. Genesis chapter 1 is the most analyzed piece of literature in the history of the human race. Its structure is astounding. Just the first verse, what it tells us about the creation and about the Creator. And so someone might think that, well, it was just an oversight by Moses, because Jesus Christ attributed the writing of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, to Moses. But this was as was inspired by the Holy Spirit. And someone who doesn't know that might think, well, Moses just forgot to write it. He just somehow omitted it, and God saw that it was good for day two. It turns out that's not true at all. If you'd like to know why there is that very specific and important omission, it turns out that what God began on day two was completed on day three. But you'll miss that unless you have a solid biblical understanding of what the firmament was, what the rakia is. So I'll offer you two resources. One, you could go to our website, rsr.org/firmament. Another way to get to it is rsr.org/day2. The second is our video on the global flood. Because in part one of that video, we highlight this and we show the astounding, the brilliant reason why God omitted saying that he saw that it was good on day two and waited to say that until day three. So if you want to see that video, you could go to our store at rsr.org. Just click on the store and purchase our Global Flood DVD, Blu-ray, or download. So you could be watching it just in a few minutes from now if you download it. Or you could go to our YouTube channel, rsr.org, and click on our YouTube channel. And there in our Real Science Radio playlist, you will see excerpts from that Global Flood video. And these will help you understand as best that we have been able to understand what is happening on day two of the creation week. So then two last topics, our UFO prediction and the observations that indicate that aliens have not been visiting our Earth and don't expect them to. Our prediction is this. With video-capable cell phones being ubiquitous, everyone's got them now, we have predicted that the frequency of claims of observed alien spaceships, not just UFOs, people take out their phone and they show some lights in the sky and they don't know what it is. And okay, that's a UFO. It's an unidentified flying object. That's very different from an alien spaceship. So this prediction is that with the frequency, with the ubiquitous presence of video-capable cell phones, claims of observed alien spaceships will diminish. You know, apparently, most aliens travel thousands of light years to get here so that they can disembowel cattle, make crop circles, and pose for photos for folks in Phoenix. That seems to be the big three things that they want to do after getting here. But in February of 2017, there was published an extensive report on UFO sightings around the world. It turns out that there has been a significant rise in reported UFO sightings overall. Now, the biggest spikes come around July 4th each year. But interestingly, the spotting of flying saucers has been on the downturn. A significant decrease in people claiming that they have seen something that looks like a flying saucer. So we think that's consistent. We won't call that a confirmed prediction yet, but we think that's consistent because, you know, people are going to claim to see what they think they could get away with. And if they claim something too dramatic, folks will say, well, where's the video? And they won't have the video. Okay. There are no UFOs piloted by aliens. In fact, there are no aliens. But just a couple years ago, Gary Bates with CMI, Creation Ministries International, published a best-selling DVD based on his book, Alien Abductions and UFOs Exposed. It has ranked as high as an Amazon.com top 50 bestseller. That's pretty good. Here are some of his arguments, and we have RSRized the list. So some of this is from our own perspective. But number one, typically UFOs are not alike. They're wildly different. If half of all these were true, which is the kind of argument you hear if you tune into some loony UFO radio program, they'll say, if even half of these are true, if even 10% of these are true, since typically no two UFOs are alike, if even 10% of these are true, that means we've been visited by 1,000 different alien civilizations because their craft are all different. We've never seen them entering our atmosphere. They're always already here when they're seen. And, you know, we're looking for signals from aliens from planets orbiting distant star systems. Well, it's a lot easier to monitor our own planet. We do that all the time because, for one, we're looking for ICBMs. And we have never seen any of these aliens who turned up in Roswell, New Mexico. We've never seen them entering the atmosphere. They're just always already here. Number three, they change shape. They morph. Well, of course they do, right? Because you see that on Star Trek. You see that in Star Wars. But for a spacecraft to morph, we're talking about nuts and bolts. So that's another indicator that people are repeating what they watch in sci-fi movies and TV programs. Aliens walk through walls when people meet the aliens. Aliens arriving here was something thought up in the 1950s and 60s as a public phenomenon. But since then, we've learned how enormous the universe is. And just to get across our own galaxy, if it was an alien civilization from across the galaxy, even at the speed of light, it would take 50,000 years. So, the nuclear physicist aliens would have to teach their children to be nuclear physicists, and then the next generation of aliens would have to teach their children to be physicists, and so on, for 50,000 years on one little spacecraft. Number six, some of the spacecraft travel problems, the energy requirements, the energy of 98 atom bombs to get 500 grams to half the speed of light. Just half the speed of light. And just 500 grams. What is a gram? About like a pea or a kernel of corn, something like that? Forget about a whole spacecraft with aliens inside. To get the mass of about 500 peas to half the speed of light, to accelerate that fast, you need the energy of 98 atom bombs. At half the speed of light, it would take 4 million years to reach our closest neighboring galaxy, Andromeda. 4 million years. In our solar system, there are 100,000 dust particles for every cubic kilometer, whereas one speck of dust at a tenth of the speed of light is like 10 tons of TNT exploding on your spacecraft. One speck of dust at that speed. For a comparison, the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1983, it was hit by a flake of paint. This was a 0.2 millimeter paint flake, pretty tiny. It cost $50,000 to repair the damage to the windshield. That tiny, tiny little paint flake. Another observation. 9 G's, right? A G is gravity. You send an astronaut up into space, even a naval aviator, and they're pulling a number of G's when they make their maneuvers. Well, at 9 G's, that can kill an Air Force pilot. 9 G's. Warp speed would be millions of G's. Make it so. Make it so. Cosmic radiation can kill you. You know why they introduce wormholes in science fiction? Because, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, to get a spaceship up to the speed of light would require a virtually infinite amount of energy. So voila, wormholes, you just go through one and you're somewhere else in the galaxy. UFOologists are big on IDH. What is IDH? The interdimensional hypothesis claim that aliens don't have bodies, so they don't need spacecraft. So they just transport themselves here. Now that's starting to sound a little bit like angels and demons, a little bit. And there certainly are those. But there are no alien civilizations who were created or who evolved on a planet far, far away. Fermi, the Italian physicist, introduced years ago the Fermi paradox. And it's this, that the universe is supposed to be so very old that if evolution happens at all, where life originates and then species evolve? Well, billions, trillions, quadrillions of civilizations should have evolved, and they should have come and gone by now in the time allotted. So the Fermi paradox is this. If life could originate in outer space, where is everybody? Why aren't they everywhere? Why aren't they communicating to us and having come here already from every corner of the galaxy and beyond? The Fermi paradox. UFOs materialize and they dematerialize. They defy the laws of physics as they accelerate toward the ground and then they do a U-turn. There's something called the classic abduction syndrome, and markers of that classic abduction syndrome include that there is a capture, and then there may be an examination, a little telepathy going on, a tour of the ship. They may take a journey and then return and experience aftermath symptoms of interference. So that's the CAS, the markers of the classic abduction syndrome. There is this phenomenon where people claim to have lost their memories, and then they go into this regression, and then they find out that they were abducted by a satanic cult, and they were being offered as a human sacrifice, but then they escaped. It happened hundreds of times over when that was the fad. When that was the fad, every other person going to recover their lost memories had that kind of recollection. And it's so similar with the fad of being abducted by a UFO. Apparently, thousands of ETs fly billions of light years, then they lie about why they're here. They kidnap people at night, and what? They're here to fix global warming? Is that really what we're told to believe? So at any rate, what an honor to have a real live astronaut on Real Science Radio. Captain Bean, what a joy to speak with him. It's so pleasant to recall the first eating and drinking on the moon was Buzz Aldrin's communion. And what a thrill that Apollo 8, their Christmas Eve broadcast to Earth. They read the entirety of the book of Genesis, chapter 1, God's creation in six literal days of the heavens, the earth, the seas, and everything in them. What a joy this has been, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Again, our website, rsr.org/moon, will get you to all of these resources. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.